Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Dean R. Lomax, internationally recognized paleontologist, author, television presenter, and science communicator. And we're talking about his new book, The Secret Lives of Dinosaurs, Unearthing the Real Behavior of Prehistoric Animals. Dean, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Hey, thank you very much. No, it's a real pleasure to be here and to chat to you about The Secret Lives of Dinosaurs.
Now, look, before we get into this, I want to pay homage to the person who illustrated this book, Bob Nichols. These are really fine color illustrations that, and there's also photography, that fill out this book. Have you known Bob for a while?
I have, yeah. So, weirdly enough, we gave a talk together recently as part of the sort of book tour we've been doing. And at one of the venues, I decided, because we met each other along what's called the Jurassic Coast in the UK, which is right down the southern end of the UK, and famous like Mariana. And I worked out exactly when I met Bob, and it actually was 14 years and 6 months ago, almost to the day today, that actually I met Bob for the first time. And so I've known him now for that length of time, almost for as long as I've been working professionally, which is 18 years this summer. And in that time, he, as a paleo artist, but also as a scientist, he's developed incredibly so. I mean, even back then, he was well known in the field of paleo art, but now, in my opinion, Mark, he sits like at the top of, in my opinion, the like paleo artist in the world, and some of the illustrations in this book are spectacular, and all of them based on what we have directly showing in the fossils, right? And that's one of the things. And I mean, I remember talking to him, obviously, you imagine, quite a bit over the course of years writing this book and back and forth, kind of working out what the illustration is that we want to show, and just seeing kind of the fossils come to life, and him, he said himself that they are literally among his greatest artworks that he's done. So he himself is he's really, really happy with what he achieved with the illustrations here. But I genuinely think they're spectacular.
This book is really unique. It's about, I think you've, in the term you used in the book is fossil forensics. It's really paleoethology, isn't it?
It is literally looking at that, and I appreciate as you say that the uniqueness of it, because kind of in the kind of dinosaur paleontology or prehistoric world for books, especially for kind of non-academic books trying to get in that kind of popular science realm, it's really, really hard to do something different with that topic, because it almost feels like it's been done kind of again and again. You know, you kind of periodically have people who bring out some really excellent books, but typically what happens every decade, there's a one kind of standout book, and it's kind of retelling the story of whether it's dinosaurs or prehistoric life, or it's kind of going through a timeline or something like that. And so when I kind of began writing this and working with Bob Nichols on this, we really have to come up with something that's very different, as you say, very unique, and in my opinion, kind of very novel. And by focusing on the direct evidence of behaviors of prehistoric animals, we originally, as you may be aware, we originally came up with this idea called Locked in Time, and then that kind of built onto something much more kind of like grander, a bigger project, which what became The Secret Lives of Dinosaurs. And kind of to this day, there's no other books that are dedicated to what is ultimately, as you say, paleoethology. So the behaviors of prehistoric animals.
Well, even if it was just about that, that would have been great. But what really sort of makes this book a sort of head and shoulders about over regular paleontology books is that you digress into a lot of personal stories about either you in the field or friends in the field or paleontology arguments, fights, slash whatever you want to call them. And that's what really makes this book. It has a very personal feel to it.
No, great. No, I appreciate that. I wanted to get quite a bit of my own personality, a little bit of humor and stuff into here, but also to help kind of build some of that community aspect of paleontology. Kind of say, like, weaving in my own stories, but then stories of some other paleontologists and fossil collectors, fossil hunters over the years. Because I think it not only is the subject amazing kind of behaviors in animals, and it's kind of mind-blowing in many respects, but I think the characters, the individuals, help kind of tell that story and give it a bit more of a of a broader appeal. And hopefully, I mean, clearly for yourself, Mark, it sounds like you've really enjoyed it and connected with it. I think it just helps tell that adventure as well, which is what I really wanted to focus on.
Well, I'm a child of the 50s, Dean. So literally one of my first books that I got was Roy Chapman Andrews' All About Dinosaurs, and I still have the original copy. But it's so different to read a book like yours, because there really is a sense of modernity and contemporary attitude, and that's what really makes this. First of all, I want to ask you, and it has seemed to me that the academic arguments in paleontology have been incredibly vicious. Is that true more than any other science?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I could say it's true of any you know, more in paleo than any other science, but I mean, maybe it is. I know there's been some major kind of issues over the years, you know, whether it's, I guess I go into some of that in
oh, you do. Oh, you do.
Yeah, and try not to kind of get into it every single kind of chapter. But yeah, I guess, especially when you have kind of really like two big opposing arguments, and then you have over the years, it might even be decades, you get other people who come through either the same lab of one professor or something, and then they kind of have that kind of ingrained within themselves, like, okay, this is an issue, and this isn't quite right, and yeah, and that continues all, you know, right through to this day. And I think it's one of the things that I do love in a respect of like paleontology and kind of the sciences in general, is that we're always kind of like heading towards trying to find that answer to, you know, to the ultimate question of whether it is in paleontology or some other sciences, that we're all kind of, you know, going towards trying to find, yeah, that ultimate kind of answer. But yeah, along the way, you're always going to have some kind of competition, or you're going to have that bit of bickering and that. And
a bit of bickering. I can remember the argument about birds and dinosaurs.
Very polite there.
Well, this book, so you're looking at fossils, and then from the fossils, interpreting behavior. And let's start simple as an example from your book. There's a lot of wild invertebrate fossil behavior that's in this book. Let's start with the millipedes, Anthropleura. You actually think that there's fossils of them courting.
Yeah.
First of all, for people who don't know what millipedes are, explain millipedes, because we see them all the time here.
Yeah. So millipedes, you'll no doubt know a millipede of kind of, you know, it's kind of a million legs in quotes, which they don't have, lots of tiny little legs. You know, they're an arthropod. You know, you find them kind of, you think kind of caterpillar, but then on a much bigger, like longer scale animal. And we have the fossil record going way back, kind of well over 300 million years. And the type that you say here, Arthropleura. So Arthropleura is a literally gigantic example of an ancient millipede relative. And these animals were living in a time called the Carboniferous, which is well known for kind of like the coal measures. You had these ancient coal forests and swamps and things. And there's even a kind of like, there was recent work published just within the last few years that showed that even Arthropleura might be the largest arthropod of all time.
Wow.
You know, which is really quite something, quite the title. And you're kind of looking at somewhere in the region of like 2.5 to maybe even 3 meters.
Whoa!
Animals. Yeah, so you know, you're nearly up at 10 feet, rather than like some of the biggest ones today are nowhere near that.
No, know?
I mean,
no.
It's pretty big at like 30, 40 centimeters or something, but yeah, nowhere near that kind of size. And so just finding the body fossils in the fossil record, there's a lot of juveniles that are known and some complete juveniles, but the really big ones are like super rare, Mark. And so finding them alone are really hard. But what we do have a lot of examples are the trace fossils. So are they like trackways? And we've got them, kind of, they've been reported almost pretty much worldwide at various different sites. And some of them are really famous from Scotland, for example. And one such specimen that was found and described in a scientific journal a few years ago now by some colleagues of mine from the University of Sheffield here in the UK, was these massive tracks that are like, you know, over like a meter wide or something. And you imagine they're kind of walking along, and they're lots of little legs are leaving footprints. And then you've got one set of tracks going one way, and then another set of tracks that are kind of going the same way. But one of the tracks are actually almost like for like, kind of the little feet, the footprints are kind of in one track, to a point where As it kind of continues, you almost go from having what you'd expect to see, like four independent tracks, you know, from one side of the animal to the other side. Obviously, you have two, and then you have another two. You have three. And it's like, well, hang on a minute, what's happening here? And the only logical explanation, especially if you compare it with modern millipedes as well and how they mate, is that when they're mating, one of them will go onto, as you can imagine, kind of upwards and onto the back of the other one, and then other species, they'll kind of come up together. And definitely what's happening is you've got evidence of them mating. And it's where they're basically, one of the footprints from one side of one of the other arthropleuras are literally almost like for like in the footprints of the other one that it's mating with. And that, as I say, is published in a peer-reviewed journal, and that study's been accepted. It must have been, I think it's well over a decade ago now, off the top of my head, when it was published. And I remember learning about this fossil a few years ago, and I was like, what? You know, you've got evidence of arthropleura mating, like these giant arthropods mating. Like, how incredible is that? But yeah, that's what the kind of level of detail that I go into in The Secret Lives, going into these kind of creatures too, because as you know, it's, as you mentioned, it's not just dinosaurs. Kind of,
oh yeah,
you know, the premise is that, yeah, the behavior of prehistoric animals, and so yeah, going back to before the dinosaurs and kind of after T-Rex and Triceratops bow out. But yeah, you probably, I imagine when you were reading that, you probably gathered that I really had a lot of fun writing that section as well.
Well, there's a whole thing about sex, prehistoric sex. I have to ask about this, the search for the fossil cloaca.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and it's so funny when you say it, but it's actually, yeah, when you think about it, it is really an interesting thing to find. And most people don't even know what the cloaca is.
Yeah, exactly. And this is the thing. So what you're talking about here is, you know, when as a paleontologist, and I guess anybody interested in dinosaur science and things, it's not necessarily that you kind of, you know, as paleontologists, I guess, we often think about kind of like the dinosaur mating lives and reproduction, right? But general public would never really kind of think about dinosaur reproduction and mating. But the reality is, this is what I say and kind of get into in the book, is that what you have to think about with prehistoric animals and living animals, we should never really separate the two, because even though many of these prehistoric animals are so unusual, extreme, and seemingly different, they still went through all these similar behaviors and things that we see in modern animals today. And of course, one being mating and reproduction. And so one of the incredible fossils that we incorporate, in the Secret Lives, and I must say as well, Bob did a wonderful job reconstructing this. I'm sure you agree. And I absolutely love doing the writing this section and getting into it. But this is of a dinosaur, a kind of bipedal cousin, very famous dinosaur Triceratops, but it's a much smaller species that was the kind of the size of say like a boar or something like that. But this animal is called Sitakosaurus, and this in particular fossil comes from China's Liaoning province. It's about 125 million years old, and now this fossil is so spectacular, and I've seen this fossil, the specimen as well, and it's on display at a museum in Frankfurt in Germany called the Senckenberg Museum, and it's a spectacular fossil because it's got all these soft tissues preserved of its skin. It even has these weird kind of feather-like structures as well in its tail. But the cool thing is that you've got right kind of in the pelvic region, you have its cloaca preserved. And like you say, like, a lot of people are like, well, what is the cloaca? Well, a cloaca is the multi-purpose orifice for mating and for excrement. So if you think of kind of like, say, chickens, you know, hens laying,
yep,
laying their eggs or doing a poo, that sort of thing, it's that orifice, it's that hole that's used. And we have that preserved in this Sitakosaurus, which preserves, you know, not only that direct evidence of a cloaca, that allows us to understand much more about how Sitakosaurus and probably many other dinosaurs would have mated, which again is absolutely mind-blowing.
Well, we should talk about the fact, you know, up until then, and up until this fossil was found,
yeah,
people assumed there was a cloaca, probably, did they? I mean, they assumed, but they never found proof of it.
That's it, exactly. And that's what made this fossil so extraordinary. So people have kind of assumed for a long time is that almost certainly they've got to have had a cloaca. But then it's kind of like, well, if they had a cloaca, how did they mate? Right?
Yeah.
So if you think of, say, for example, 10,000 plus species of birds and kind of crocodilians and things like that, animals that have cloacas, it's kind of like, well, there's often kind of quite a standard of, okay, this is what they did. But also it varies quite considerably from some different families of living crocs to, say, living families of birds and things. And so trying to work out exactly how these would have mated is what makes it really hard. And in terms of Arstotachosaurus, the chances are, based on the anatomy of the cloaca, it actually resembles more of like a crocodilian, not quite the same, but more like a crocodilian, which suggests at least for Sitakosaurus, but also probably for that wider group Ceratopsians, Triceratopsian. And again, if you go back far enough along the family tree, where this dinosaur splits off, would also strongly suggest that most dinosaurs probably would have mated, not with something like what we call like a cloacal kiss, where some birds will come together and they kind of touch their cloacas, but instead they would have had, the males would have probably had a penis, like a crocodile, and it would have gone through the kind of the same process like in crocodiles today. Their penis is hidden inside their cloaca, and obviously during mating comes out. That's what it would suggest based on this fossil, which again, you would never even saw going back 20-odd years or something. You'd have thought, oh yeah, you'll never find a fossil cloaca. You could never really understand the sex lives of dinosaurs. Well, actually, these are the incredible fossils that provide that level of detail, which is just, as I say, remarkable to even think that we had that. And one thing I wanted to say, because you brought this one up, is you probably had a good laugh or a good chuckle at the fact of when this went, when this study originally was published. And I should say Bob Nichols was one of the co-authors, one of the scientists, not only on the study and obviously brought this animal to life, but he was actually one of the scientists. As you can imagine, dinosaur sex, dinosaur penises and things, it ended up going viral in social media. And
of course,
and,
of course.
Yeah, as you can imagine. And it was quite incredible because Bob, I say this to him, I tease him at some of the talks, that he can now be credited as the very first person to scientifically and accurately reconstruct a dinosaur butthole.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Dr. Dean R. Lomax, internationally recognized paleontologist, author, television producer, and science community here. And we're talking about his new book. It's really a great read. Fascinating and real enjoyable. The Secret Lives of Dinosaurs, Unearthing the Real Behaviors of Prehistoric Animals. Dean, one of the things that springs up about the cloaca, though, is that some of the fossils you look at in this book suggest that there were also some alternative ways of breeding or raising young. And let me start with, I think it's Hyphalosaurus or Christodeer, that the way that they breed, that they probably have live young and eggs. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so that is a really interesting beastie called, yeah, you're quite right, good pronunciation there, called Hyphalosaurus. And Hyphalosaurus is this, if you kind of saw a reconstruction of them, or even if you saw a fossil, you'd be like, well, yeah, it kind of looks a bit like, like some sort of like weird crocodile creature or a lizard. And you'd be like, well, okay, I'd probably buy that. But it's not that. They are an unusual group of reptiles that do sort of resemble crocs or lizards, and they're called Charistodeers, and they have quite an interesting history. They've been around for you know, well over 100 million years, and they disappeared several million years after the big extinction that wiped out T-Rex and co. But what we kind of focus on in the book, I give two really extraordinary examples. And the first one being, as you say, looking at kind of the live birth and egg laying, one of the things that they have is, we have two examples. One of them is pregnant with multiple little fetuses. And each of these little fetuses have developed, they're about kind of roughly about 5-ish centimeters, 6 centimeters long. And by studying many other what we call neonates, so newborns that were found in the same rocks, and also I should say these are from a similar area to the Sitakosaurus, Leonin province, and from the Cretaceous about 120, 125 million years ago. We have thousands of Hyphalosaurus fossils. So you're able to examine lots of these, you know, like literally thousands of specimens, and work out that this individual was very close to parturition, so close to actually giving birth. And that would have given live birth. And we have other examples where you've got little Hyphalosaurus kind of dotted around the mother-to-be. But then on the flip side, you have other examples that show they are preserved in little eggs as well, like as in like little egg capsules, probably like a soft-shelled egg. Now, that is absolutely incredible because that's a thing called bimodal reproduction that we do see very rarely today in some species of reptiles, where the females are able to reproduce by both means, by live birth and by laying eggs. And to have that again in the fossil record opens up so much about the behavior and life of these creatures.
It's weird. There's some fossils in this book that I think are just elegant. They're really wonderful. One of the examples I'm thinking about is the Starkiss fossils of feeding squid.
Yeah.
That to me was really special. That was really interesting. Talk about that.
Yeah, so these are, this goes back to kind of, actually, funnily enough, it's, we talked about my kind of personal kind of stories and things that I kind of weaved into here and into the book. And that's kind of one of them, right? So I had, I'd spent a lot of my time working in Wyoming in the States and volunteering at several museums, especially working, volunteering at a museum called the Wyoming Dinosaur Center. And I remember this was way back in 2008. Kind of close towards the beginning of my professional career. And I remember back then seeing some of these fossils in several museums that we visited at the time. And they kind of had, you imagine like just a block of rock, say like a limestone of rock, and you have these like star shapes in there. And for a long time, people never quite realized what these creatures were, because they were kind of like, well, are they a trace fossil by... some animal kind of leaving a weird like walk behind, or is it like a feeding trace, or is it a...
And they're perfectly star-shaped. We should talk about that.
Absolutely. Yeah, they're perfectly star-shaped, a thing that we call like stellate.
Yep.
And they were originally described back in, I think it was the 1940s, if I remember correctly, from these sites in Wyoming, and I think there's a site in Montana, if I remember correctly, from what I wrote about. Yeah, it was in Montana as well. And nobody could quite work out what they were. And amazingly, colleagues at the way back then at the American Museum of Natural History have been kind of looking at them and being like, well, what could they be? You know, they're very strange. And then kind of more fossils started to be found. And eventually, they were found at different sites in Wyoming, some other sites in Montana and the neighboring states as well. And what we were looking at, as you say, they're perfectly formed, these like star-shaped structures. And some of them had little kind of like marks along the what looked like, let's say you've got eightfold symmetry on them. One or two of the what looked like arm impressions had like these weird little hook shaped things. And so this allowed people to start to understand, the scientists who were studying them back in the day and more recently too. And I mean, even personally, I've looked at a lot of this material, studied some of this material. They started to realize, well, actually, maybe these are from the hooks from the arms of squid. And so potentially, are we looking at these star-shaped like squid kisses, I call them? Are they where you've got an ancient squid from well over 100 million years ago kind of either feeding on the seabed or depositing its eggs or something? And then this is where the scientists way back then started to think, well, actually, maybe that's what it is. And then by comparing with some incredible fossils from Germany, from places like famous sites like Solnhofen, famous for things like Archaeopteryx, the early dino bird. There are also places like Holzmaden in Germany, which again is famous for ichthyosaurs and plesiosaurs. Several ancient squids, Jurassic squids, were found with the 8 or 10 arms preserved with the hooks, some of them even leaving an impression behind in the rock. Yeah, essentially marrying up this mystery that had been kind of plaguing scientists from way back in the 1940s. To work out exactly what was going on, that this was some sort of feeding trace left behind by an ancient squid, or even, as they say, even something like depositing eggs on the sea floor. And so it took a long time to work out exactly what they were. And I got to tell you, though, Mark, they're really intriguing things. I remember I looked at them probably about 18 years ago when I was first in Wyoming at several museums. But even within the last, probably, I think it was 3 years ago, I was at a museum in Wyoming called the Tate Museum, mm-hmm. and I talk about the Tate Museum in the book as well a little bit, and they also had some recently collected material, and some of this stuff was even published in a journal just a few years ago, like, because the story, this is one of the things with this, and as you say, it's like, it's not just the amazing fossils, but it's the story that they tell, and that community aspect of people studying them and getting excited by them. And one of the people who I mentioned there in the book and referenced their work is Dr. Melissa Connolly as well, who she, within the last 5-10 years, has spent a good chunk of time finding new sites with these incredible squid kisser trace fossils.
It's amazing, and we're almost out of time. We could be talking about this book, and we could talk about it for years. No, it's, we could be talking about it for years, but it really does seem. Is there now a separate like form of paleontology that's like fossil forensics or paleoethology? It seems like to be that, to do that well, you have to be familiar with not only living examples, but other sort of ancient examples, a fossil example. It's a complicated field of study.
It is. And I personally, it's funny, I never really started out like this, but going back to the first time that I was working as a paleontologist, working my way up to be a paleontologist when I was way back, when I was 18 years old, my first kind of introduction to this, I'd heard about some incredible fossils like the fighting dinosaur fossil Mongolia of Velociraptor and Protoceratops fighting. But I was aware then of how extraordinarily rare it was to find evidence of behavior, right, of ethology. And then I remember seeing this incredible horseshoe crab trackway of a Jurassic horseshoe crab that had been flung into a lagoon. It kind of rolled around, it righted itself, and it was literally dead in its tracks. And it walked for 9.7 meters, like 33 feet. That's incredible. And that blew my mind. And it really changed the way I thought about fossils. And so kind of as I began digging deeper into literature, no pun intended, digging deeper into literature kind of over my professional career, I've written and published a bunch of papers on, say, pregnant ichthyosaurs.
Yeah.
Their last meals, that sort of thing. And you, as you say, you're quite right. Not only do you have to have a good understanding, or at least a very basic understanding of kind of behaviors in modern animals, and that might be by reviewing the literature published on modern animals, but also, of course, by just simply going outside and studying animals too, and being mindful of you could make, say, comparisons between, I could say, I don't know, let's go for a walk in the woods and you see a squirrel caching its nuts, that sort of thing. And
Dean, we're all out of time.
Is that right? Yeah.
To give an example, we've literally just talked about two little pieces of the book. My guest tonight is Dr. Dean R. Lomax, internationally recognized paleontologist, author, television presenter, and science communicator. And we're talking about his book, and I'll tell you, the last chapter is the weirdest fossil in the book, and I didn't want to give it away. I when I saw the cover, I went, what? And then it was revealed at the end, and oh my God, The Secret Lives of Dinosaurs. Unearthing the Real Behaviors of Prehistoric Animals. Dean, it's been a real pleasure.
Oh, it's a real pleasure to chat with you too, Mark. I had a lot of fun, and this is it. This is the time flies by when you're having fun, right?
Yeah, it's true.
We got to go.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.